Good afternoon, Mrs. Goldstein. I am Mrs. Arnold Block, and this is Mrs. Julius Elson.
How do you do, Mrs. Goldstein?
We have come to do the tape recording that was scheduled for today of yours and Dr. Goldstein's life together. And before we begin this, we want to thank you so much for receiving us so warmly, and thank you, too, for taking the time to grant us this interview. If it's all right with you, Mrs. Goldstein, Mrs. Elson and I will both question you. If we get out of hand, just stop us. And I believe Mrs. Elson would like to ask the first question.
Mrs. Goldstein, can you tell us who Mr. William Goldstein was?
He was my husband's father, William Goldstein.
Oh, just put it over there. Thank you.
What else do you want to know?
How old was Mr. Goldstein?
He was 65 when he died in February 1905.
And what did he do, Mrs. Goldstein?
Well, he was, for quite a long time, a man of leisure who looked after his own affairs, but principally real estate.
Was Dr. Goldstein an only child?
No, there were two sisters, but he was an only son.
Ms. Goldstein, can you tell us why did Dr. Goldstein have pock marks on his face?
Yes, because there was a smallpox epidemic in St. Louis when he was a child of about 2 years, and he contracted smallpox, and that left him with a pockmarked face all for the rest of his life.
Yes, so that didn't hinder him in any of his good work.
No.
Mrs. Goldstein, we know that you have traveled extensively, and can you recall any of your travels abroad subsequent to the postgraduate study of Dr. Goldstein?
Oh, yes, indeed.
We went to Europe frequently. It was usually, though, for Dr. Goldstein's month's work in Vienna. And he went to take up new work that had come out in the meantime in his own profession. And then he would join me. My mother-in-law and I usually went to some resort for her to take a cure. We went frequently to Karlsbad, and I never spent more wonderful days in all my life than in Karlsbad. It's the most fascinating place. It's now, of course, in Czechoslovakia. And I don't know whether many Americans go there now or not. I never hear of anyone. But, oh, it was a delightful spot, right in the mountains. And this lovely, quaint little village that had every luxury that even the Paris markets could afford. Just everything that was beautiful, that was manufactured anywhere in the world, was represented there in Karlsbad. And there was just one long street, down which a lovely little clear brook rippled. But it was altogether a place that impressed you with its simplicity, and yet you could spend fortunes in jewelry and beautiful furs and magnificent linens. Everything that was beautiful could be bought in these little shops in Karlsbad. And a very cosmopolitan audience. Really, the people came from all over the world to take the cure there and probably also to buy the luxuries that were there.
Did you climb?
No, I didn't. No.
Mrs. Goldstein, did Dr. Goldstein have a university appointment in Europe, or did he go just mainly for research and study?
Study.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a house in Frankfort, Michigan? And if so, is there a photograph available of the house?
I don't know of one that's available. I haven't heard of one shortly, but I don't know where it is now. My mother built that little house 45 years ago. One summer, she was tired of running around each summer to a different place to pass part of the warm term. And she said, I'm going to go out and look for some place where I can settle down. So she went up to Milwaukee with her, where she had relatives, and she told them her story, and they recommended several places. Well, she went there, but she didn't care for any of them. And finally, she crossed Lake Michigan from Milwaukee, and the boat landed in Frankfort, which was a little port. And she got off there and looked around the little village. It was a very pretty little place. And she said, a few hours after she had looked around, she said, well, this is the place I'm going to settle. And she walked around, talked to some of the people who were had real estate, and they offered her a lot on the lake shore, right on the lake. Well, she was down there one evening, and the noise of the waves drove her nearly crazy. So she said she wouldn't find out that she couldn't be that near to the water. So she walked up into the village and found a very desirable lot. And before the next day was over, she had bought it. Then it was a question of where she going to find somebody to build her house. So there was a carpenter living up there, and he was used to doing all sorts of work. In fact, not just carpenter work, but the plumbing and the electricity and everything he could do. So she had a little conference with him, and they decided on what the main issues of this little house would be. And before you know it, he had a pretty nice plan. And when we came home from Europe, we were in Europe, when he came home, by that time my mother had written me that she had bought a lot in Frankfort. Well, Frankfort was an utterly unknown place to me, except that a good many St. Louis's had been going there. You know, there had been a good-sized hotel there which burned down. And after that, it was just a resort that not many people could come to because there was no other hotel. And before next spring came, my mother had a completed house. And she had even done bedspreads and done tablecloths and things that she thought would be an addition to the cottage. And when the 1st of June came, she and her maid made the pilgrimage up to Frankfort. And that was really one of the happiest incidents of our whole life, that house up in Frankfort. And my mother went religiously summer after summer, and all she did up there was to put up fruit and make preserves and sit on the porch and have a wonderful time chatting with people. And then we began to go up too. We took turns going because the cottage wouldn't hold us all. And we just loved Frankfort.
Mrs. Goldstein, what year did you say the house was built?
Well, let me see. The house is about 45 years old now. So that was 1915, yes.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. There are other things. I know that Dr. Goldstein's work had four aspects to it. The practice of otolaryngology was one, and I know you'll want to do some elaborating on that before we get on to the other three. There's the laryngoscope. Is that a journal that he published?
Yes. He founded it and published it, and it is still published.
Yes.
Every month.
And we'll go back to these. How about Central Institute? That was a very small place in the beginning, wasn't it?
Yes. It began very small, but by the second year, it had already registered 10 children. The first registration was 4. The second year was 10. And the next year was already up in the 20s.
Yes. Well, now, we're going back over all of this in a few minutes. We also know that Dr. Goldstein was an avid art collector and that you do have a very fine collection.
Oh, we haven't a very good collection anymore.
Oh, you don't?
No, a good many were sold.
Yes.
All for the benefit of Central Institute.
Yes, would you want to talk about that part first, then, and tell us about that?
Well, if you like.
Absolutely.
Well, I'll tell you about the first picture that we bought. He had been buying prints and illustrations, but had not yet bought an oil painting. And one day I came here, if you remember Strauss's studio over on Franklin Avenue. I don't think either of you can remember that.
I've heard of it.
Yes. Well, I was over there one day, and there was a secondhand store right next door. And I stopped and looked in the window, and I saw what I thought was a very beautiful picture. I can show it to you because it's here. And I came home, and I said to Dr. Goldstein, I saw a very pretty picture today, really a lovely, peaceful, calm picture. And without saying a word to me, he went over there and bought it. The next thing I knew, that picture was in our room. Oh, I said, my mentioning it, that didn't mean that I wanted it. Not at all. Well, he was very happy with it. So that led to one or two more. And then it led to going to auctions, not here, but in New York. And it became so that the appetite for art was almost a consuming one. He was so fond of the arts, of drawing and of painting. And he became particularly interested in drawings. And going to Europe each summer, as we did for quite a while, I've been in Europe 16 times, so your doctor was in Europe more than that. He was there about at least 18 times. But that gave him the opportunity to go into drawing shops, to go into art shops. And whenever he got through with his laryngological work, or ear, nose, and throat work, he'd go to the art shop. And I wouldn't see him for hours. Just, he'd say, well, I'm going to be out today, and I don't know just when I will come back. And I'd say, well, remember, we have tickets for the theater, and I'm not going to miss that theater. He'd stay all day. Well, he gradually then acquired an acquaintance with the art people. And there are several to whom I could write today, and they'd know me and know what Max used to do there. He'd spend days in those shops. Then he was also a great book collector. That library over in Central Institute is one of the rare ear, nose, and throat libraries. Since that time, there may have been other men who have been interested in books, in old books, but he never came in the house without a book catalog under his arm or in his pocket. Day after day, until they got so that they were a tremendous nuisance in my house, the book catalogs. But he had really some very valuable old books, just the beginning of the science, right straight through. But this artwork, that was a passion, because he read art constantly at night. Usually when he'd go to bed, he'd have 2-3 catalogs, and he had a very retentive memory, so that it soon became a very well-drilled art library in his head and the knowledge of drawing. Well, he collected those until after he passed away. I suppose I easily had 2,000 drawings. Had safes that we held them, kept them in, and it was a very interesting collection. He used to say, if anything happened to me, what on earth are you going to do with all these things? Well, I said, if that's what you think, why do you keep on collecting? Because it won't be easy for me to dispose of them, that's one thing, sure. And you can't really lessen a collection if you just dispose of two or three or four at a time, not when you have that many. Well, do you want me to go on?
Yes, oh, please go on, yes.
Oh, well, these, he collected principally in London. London is, as you know, a market for everything. Doesn't make any difference what you're looking for. The greatest amount of that particular thing can be found in London. And this is gospel truth, that we got off the boat and took a train up to London, and I had rooms engaged from over here, and we were in a taxi with our baggage, and he said to me, would you mind if you went to the hotel with this baggage and I'll meet you there later on? He went first to the book dealer. Before he got out of that taxi, I registered at the hotel. So, well, it was interesting to live with those tendencies. And the thing was that he would look at a catalog and he'd see, well, this thing was published in 1682. He could remember that. He could remember where he saw it, in what catalog the book was announced or cataloged. This is, I keep sliding it down.
I think you're going into it all right, so mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there was just no end to the interest that came into our lives through these things. And then it put you in association with these people. And when we came to Europe, there was always an anchor for you. And we met interesting people through it. We met one particularly interesting man. His name was Spencer, Mr. Spencer. And he had a secondhand bookshop. And in order to obtain the books, well, I must tell you this, that a great many men in England, as they call them, gentlemen, collected drawings and collected books. Now, when men died, their collections, their libraries were sold. And Mr. Spencer was in the habit of buying up these books and drawings. I myself have been in his storerooms and have seen drawings, sheets upon sheets, piled up as high as I could reach, and a whole room full of those piles, one right after the other. Well, Mr. Spencer was very particular whom he let come into those storerooms. But Dr. Goldstein was always welcome. He just made a big fuss over Max and welcomed him. Oh, you've come back. You've come back this year. And he saved things that he thought Max would be interested in. And once these drawings and books were mostly collected in country houses. You see, a gentleman in England is something very special, and especially the ones of 100 years back, and their belongings were all sort of intellectual pursuits. And Spencer bought these and then sold them in his London shop. The shop was the most awful looking thing you ever saw in your life. Max used to look like a ragamuffin when he came back. He'd be so dirty, and he'd be sitting way up one of the upper floors. Mind you, this was an old, old building in High Holborn, where the second-hand bookshops were. But he didn't care about that. He just sat there. It was really terrible. The way he'd come home, I'd hate to see him come through the hotel lobby. But he certainly enjoyed those beautiful things, just had a reverence for them. Well, that was the way he collected. And after he once collected, he didn't want to part with it. Then New York also is a market for drawings, but no appreciation of them here. A few men, but they also didn't buy here. They bought elsewhere in London. And let me see, who were some of the collectors? Old Mr. Polk was one.
Oh, yeah.
Over there, his father.
Mm-hmm.
And Lionberger Davis, who's given such wonderful things to our library, our art museum. And Dr. Clopton, if you remember him. Dr. Clopton had beautiful prints, wonderful prints he gave them. Horace Swope had beautiful, beautiful prints. You remember him? You don't remember him. Well, it was the Swope Shoe Company, the son of the owner of the shoe company. He had, and he's given them all to the art museum. They're very beautiful ones. Well, then the oil paintings were collected much slower than that, but it was easy when you had the catalog sent to you from New York to see what you wanted, if you cared. He bought at the museums, at the art shops, where there were auctions, at the place that is now Park Burnett, you know, the big auction house that sells pictures into the thousands and thousands now. But that developed from these different art shops that were in New York, the American Arts, I've forgotten the names of all of them. But at each period, there was one leading art shop that sold it up, just as there is now.
Mrs. Goldstein, then I assume, from what you say, that Doctor first began collecting prints and other mediums than oil.
Yes. Yes.
What, watercolor?
Well, it was pen drawings and pencil drawings.
Well, we according to what we have here, we have the first venture of doctors. It's the practice of otolaryngology, and I suppose that he was in practice for quite some years before he went to the Central Institute.
Yes, he founded the Central Institute in 1914, and he began the practice of otology in 1894. After he graduated from medical school, then he went to the city hospital and interned there. And then from there he went to Europe, and he spent two years in Europe specializing. There was a doctor here in St. Louis who was an ear specialist. Now, you know, this was a good many years ago, and otology was just really beginning as a specialty. Dr. Todd was his name, and my husband had a great affection for him, and he advised him to take up otology when he went to Europe for the first time. and gave him the names of the professors with whom he should study, and he did that. And then after that, he continued by going to Europe as often as he could and studying with some of the great men, Dr. Politzer, the father of modern otology, and he studied pathology. He went to Strasbourg and studied there. Then he went to Berlin and worked there. And then his last stop was London. Worked at the London Hospital? I don't know what the name was. It's still there, the same hospital down in the busy part of London. King's College, I think, was the name of it.
When did he begin editing laryngoscopes?
1896.
And how did that come about?
Well, he and a friend, a young otologist, had offices, their first offices, right next to each other, down on Jefferson and Locust. If you remember, a little office building down there called the Erickson Building. And they were both otologists. And I don't know, just as Max was very avid in his reading, he found that there was an absence of the study of otology and inward and throat studies. So he began it. And each one put in $100 to start this journal. And they published it for about 2 years. They circularized the profession. Of course, it was something that was financially on their shoulders for several years. Good many years, in fact. Well, in the meantime, the Spanish-American War broke out. There was a war with Cuba. Of course, it was Spanish, but was centered here in the Cuban waters. Well, Frank Rumbold had always been a National Guard man, something of that sort. So he volunteered for the Army. So that left Max alone. And afterwards, this war spread to the Philippines. And Frank Rumbold was sent to the Philippines. So there was no contact with him for the journal. And he himself found out that he was so interested in the war situation that when the war stopped, he was going to take up the military life and military work. So when he came back here on one of his trips, he suggested that they dissolve this little partnership, and Max took it over himself. And from that time on, he's published it, and we are publishing it today. I have the same secretary over there. It's in the Washington University Medical School, the journal. She will be there 35 years next summer. She's really I hate to say publisher. He's not the publisher, but she's the editor. Dr. Walsh is the editor, but Mrs. Lutz does all the work. And she came over here yesterday to talk to me. I still am the nominal owner of it. I don't get anything out of it. I just am the owner. And I was particularly anxious to stay in it, because after that many years of publishing, I didn't want the journal to go out of existence.
No.
I wanted it continued. And it is being continued, and it will be.
Now, we'll get to the Special Institute. You did give us a little on it when we first started the interview, but can you now...
Yes. Well, I'll tell you how Central Institute came to be started. Max worked in the Jewish clinic down on 9th and Cass or someplace, wherever the Jewish clinic was at that time. And as time went on, he began to have deaf children come into his clinic for help. And he had paid particular attention to that kind of work in Vienna. And there was one professor, Professor Obrancic, with whom he had very close relations. And Obrancic was a man who was also making a great effort to help the deaf child. And he was very glad to have an American who was interested. So he took particular pains with Max to take him to the Deaf Institute in Vienna and take up the subject really almost as a special subject, aside from operating on mastoids and tonsil operations and things of that sort. Well, when he came home, as I say, he went into the Jewish clinic and he found these deaf children. As soon as he began to investigate, he found that there was no place where a child could be taught orally. He was a definite advocate of the oral method. He didn't want any of this business and this hand motions and all that. And that was being pursued everywhere in America at that time. They thought it was impossible to teach a child orally. So he'd come home and he'd say, well, you know, we had another deaf child in our clinic today. Now, what am I going to do with that child? I know that there's no treatment possible. This is just utterly a waste of time.